Kuhn Review, Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @KuhnReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@kuhnreview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com. Or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
This is from The National on Friday, the 22nd of March, 2024, from the news section. Donald Trump's Scottish properties could be seized within days. This article is written by Xander Eliards. The two Scottish golf courses owned by former US President Donald Trump could be seized within days after he was found guilty of fraudulently inflating the valuations of his properties in order to dupe banks and lenders. Trump and his two eldest sons were all barred from doing business in New York for 2 to 3 years in a fraud ruling which also saw the Republican presidential candidate ordered to pay a staggering $464 million, that's £363 million. However, Trump's lawyers have said it is a practical impossibility for him to secure a bond for the cash. In the court document reported by Newsweek and filed on Monday, they said, "The amount of the judgment, with interest, exceeds $464 million, and very few bonding companies will consider a bond of anything approaching that magnitude. Despite scouring the market, we have been unsuccessful in our efforts to obtain a bond for the judgment amount for defendants for the simple reason that obtaining an appeal bond for $464 million is a practical impossibility under the circumstances presented. If Trump still has not found the money by March the 25th, New York Attorney General Letitia James could begin seizing some of his assets. The properties that could be taken off him include those which had fraudulent and misleading values assigned to them. So which of Donald Trump's properties could be seized? According to a document reported by Newsweek, the properties that could be seized include Trump's famous Mar-a-Lago, Florida estate and Trump Tower in New York. The list also includes both of his Scottish golf courses, Trump International Golf Links Scotland Aberdeen and Trump International Golf Links Scotland Turnberry. In Aberdeen, a US judge found it had been wrongly stated that 2,500 homes had already been built at the Trump property as part of a project associated with the loss-making golf club. However, there was planning permission to build only 500 and no development had taken place. The other Trump properties which could be seized are Trump Park Avenue, New York, 40 Wall Street, New York, Seven Springs, Westchester County, New York, Trump International Hotel and Tower, Las Vegas, Trump National Golf Club, Westchester, Briarcliff Manor, New York, Trump National Golf Club, Charlotte, Mooresville, North Carolina, Trump National Golf Club, Colts Neck, New Jersey, Trump National Golf Club, Washington, D.C., Trump National Golf Club, Hudson Valley, Hopewell Junction, New York, Trump National Golf Club, Jupiter, Florida, Trump National Golf Club, Los Angeles, California, Trump National Golf Club, Philadelphia, New Jersey. Trump has indicated that he plans to appeal the $464 million ruling against him. However, in order to do so, he must deposit the full amount with the court. he has previously said that he may have to hold a fire sale of assets in order to come up with the money, wrongly claiming the deposit rule is a first. Trump wrote on social media, "Judge Arthur Engoron wants me to put up the ridiculous fine, 'I did nothing wrong,' in capitals, before I get a chance to appeal his crazed ruling, a first." He went on, "Judge Engoron actually wants me to put up hundreds of millions of dollars for the right to appeal his ridiculous decision. Nobody has ever heard of anything like this before. I would be forced to mortgage or sell great assets, perhaps at fire sale prices, and if and when I win the appeal, they would be gone. Does that make sense? Witch hunt, election interference." That article was written by Xander Eliards. This is from The National on Friday, the 22nd of March, 2024, from the news section. Glasgow City Chambers urged to stop flying Union flag on royal birthdays. This exclusive article is written by Adam Robertson. Scottish Greens councillors in Glasgow have called for the Union flag to no longer be flown on royal birthdays. The current policy sees the Union flag raised over the city chambers on a number of royal birthdays, including those of the Princess of Wales, King Charles III, Queen Camilla, and Princess Anne, according to Glasgow City Council's website. The Scottish Greens group are to propose a motion to call for this policy to be dropped and to instead introduce a policy to raise the flag of countries home to cities which Glasgow is twinned with, Councillor Dan Hutchison for the Govan ward told The National. He said he didn't know anybody he could ask who would know when the King's birthday was. "I'm a Republican. I always have been a Republican, but I think it's probably fair to say from my perspective that the Queen was probably a bit different, and there was quite a lot of respect for the longevity that she had in the role," he said. The councillor added, "But now nobody really cares. Charles has never had a great reputation, and it's not really 21st century Scotland. Our thinking is Glasgow has always tried to be an internationalist city, so we're trying to move back to that rather than the royal stuff I don't think anyone cares about. Glasgow has large diasporas from these countries. Our perspective is then more important than some unelected people that live down in England somewhere, so we should celebrate the people that live here, the people we work with day in, day out, rather than folk that fly in every so often, do very little and live on taxpayer money. Glasgow is currently twinned with the following cities: Turin, Italy; Nuremberg, Germany; Lahore, Pakistan; Mykolaiv, Ukraine; Havana, Cuba; Bethlehem, Palestine; Marseille, France; Dalian, China. It was previously twinned with Rostov-on-Don in Russia, although this was suspended following Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Hutchison further explained that the group will call for a public consultation with the Chinese diaspora in Glasgow on flying their flag, given the country's political climate. He added that the meeting where the motion could be heard will take place next Thursday, although he says it is likely to be low down on the agenda. "Hopefully it gets heard then, but you never know in politics. We haven't had any discussions with any other groups about it just yet, though. It's not the first instance of councillors trying to distance their city from the royals, as we told of a similar motion in Edinburgh last year ahead of the coronation. The Greens group in Edinburgh said that the Duke of Edinburgh's title should not be formally recognised by the Scottish capital." That article was written by Adam Robertson. This is from The National on Friday the 22nd of March 2024 from the comments section. Here's how to cut Scotland's material consumption levels. This article is written by Kim Pratt, Friends of the Earth Scotland circular economy campaigner. In Scotland, the way we use materials is extremely wasteful. When we buy things, from clothes and laptops to toasters and washing machines, they often break easily and are difficult to repair. Many products, especially food and drink containers, are actually designed to be used once and then thrown away. This means everyone buys more and more stuff, which boosts the profits of big businesses, but it's expensive for consumers and a disaster for the planet. The more resources we extract from nature, the more damage we cause to our environment and to the lives of people around the world. The drive to use ever more materials is linked to our growth-obsessed economy. The easiest way for businesses to increase their profits is to sell more, which means the demand for more materials always rises. But this endless demand for more materials is strangely out of line with the Scottish Government's story about carbon emissions. They claim Scotland's carbon emissions are shrinking, but how can this be if our economy keeps growing, fed by ever-increasing material consumption? The answer is that ministers are choosing to ignore an increasingly large part of our carbon footprint. Only carbon which is emitted in Scotland counts towards the Scottish Government's official climate targets. Emissions from imported products are excluded. This climate blind spot now accounts for over half of Scotland's carbon footprint. Scotland's desire for more material is still contributing to the global problem, even if that pollution is recorded in another country's climate stats. This offshoring trend is seen across many of the key materials we use in our economy, not just the ones we buy as consumers. Steel, which is essential for infrastructure projects from bridges to buildings and wind turbines, is a clear example of this. When the Ravenscraig steel mill closed in 1992, it wiped 3.5 million tonnes of carbon off Scotland's carbon balance sheets. But Scotland's demand for steel didn't stop. In fact, it has grown. Today, we import all the steel we need, with much less control over the production process. The good news is that there is a way to fix this blind spot. The Scottish Government can create a new target, in line with our existing climate commitments, that will reduce the impact of our consumption. This week, the Scottish Parliament will have an opportunity to support fairer and more sustainable material use when it votes on a new circular economy law. Our current approach to materials is described as a linear economy, where we take resources from nature, use them briefly, and then dispose of them, usually in landfill or incinerator. The target would drive the Scottish Government to introduce policies to minimise material use and ensure the products we buy will last longer. By encouraging more reuse and repair, we can learn new skills and help people save money on the things they buy. Businesses which put unsustainable and non-recyclable products on our shelves should be made to take responsibility for cleaning them up when they are littered in our streets and dumped in the oceans. Currently, greedy businesses can keep passing the costs of cleaning up their mess onto the public purse. A circular economy creates new job opportunities too. Building one steel recycling plant in Scotland could create 650 jobs and add £400 million to the Scottish economy. But this won't happen without support from government to give people the security and skills they need to make these changes. The new circular economy law must recognise this. Creating a world with less stuff can bring benefits for everyone. It means the things we buy are better made and are easier to fix, as well as cutting carbon emissions and creating jobs. But we must act now before the whole world turns into one big rubbish dump. Ignoring how much our imports damage the planet doesn't stop it happening. Scotland's new circular economy law is the first step towards a fairer and more sustainable future. But this will only happen if it is honest about all the impacts of our consumption, including imports. That article was written by Kim Pratt, Friends of the Earth Scotland Circular Economy Campaigner. This is from The National on Friday, the 22nd of March, 2024, from the news section. Scotland's cities rise in world rankings of top financial centres. This article is written by Laura Pollock. Two Scottish cities have both risen in the world rankings of financial centres, according to new figures released. Scotland's financial services industry continues to compete on the global stage as Glasgow jumped up 9 places to 42nd, whilst Edinburgh moved up 1 place to 33rd in the Global Financial Centres Index. The index, which measures the competitiveness of financial centres around the world, is based on several indices in combination with a regular questionnaire of senior industry figures from across the world. Financial and related professional services are the largest contributor to the Scottish economy, adding around £14.3 billion gross value-added GVA annually. The industry directly employs around 136,000 people, with many thousands more in the supply chain, and with salaries a third higher than the average wage in Scotland. S&P figures have said the new rankings show that Scotland's financial services industry continues to thrive, with two cities ranked in the top 50 worldwide. A recent new growth sector strategy launched with Scottish financial industry aims to double assets under management in Scotland's financial services sector to £1 trillion by 2030. Minister for Business, Trade, Tourism and Enterprise, Ivan McKee, said the figures confirm Scotland as a global leader in financial services. He added, "The impressive rankings are testament to the work and engagement of businesses and organisations across Glasgow and Edinburgh, and the wider financial services industry. The recently launched financial services growth strategy highlighted key milestones and goals for measuring our growth within Scotland, and this index forms part of these measures. Therefore, it is great news to see that both Glasgow and Edinburgh are firmly competing on the global stage and helping support our own well-being economy and focus on economic growth." That article was written by Laura Pollock. This is from The National on Friday, the 22nd of March, 2024, from the Culture section. Stone of Destiny to be reunited with fragment held by SNP. This article is written by Aaron Burns-Lees. A fragment of the Stone of Destiny, in possession by the SNP, is set to be reunited with the rest of the stone at the new Perth Museum. Scottish Government papers reveal that in 2008, the fragment of the stone was gifted to the SNP by John McCormick's son, Professor Sir Neil McCormick, and it has subsequently been safely housed in SNP HQ. In light of this information, MP for Perth and North Perthshire wrote to Mary Foote, SNP Chief Executive, to request for the fragment to be given to the new Perth Museum. The SNP National Executive Committee, NEC, has since agreed for it to be passed to the keepers of the regalia, with a request for it to be reunited with the rest of the stone at Perth Museum. Wishart welcomed the news, saying, When I heard that this fragment was in SNP HQ, I was keen to ensure that it could be reunited with the stone at its new home at Perth Museum. I am absolutely delighted that the SNP has agreed to this request and that the fragment is being passed on. I also hope the keepers of the regalia will favourably consider the party's request that it is displayed along with the stone if its provenance is confirmed. This fragment has its own particular story and will be a fantastic addition to the rich tapestry and mystery surrounding the stone. I am grateful to all at SNP HQ for the helpful way in which they are cooperating with its return. It is understood that the fragment is soon to be assessed by Historic Environment Scotland on behalf of the keepers of the regalia in order to verify that it is indeed part of the original stone. Foote said, "When Pete first wrote to us, we wanted to do everything possible to ensure that the fragment was given to the new Perth Museum, to be viewed by the Scottish public, with the rest of the stone. I am pleased it has been given over to the safekeeping of the keepers of the regalia, with our request that it is reunited with the rest of the stone. Given its unique journey from its origins to our stewardship, we hope to see it on full display in the near future." That article was written by Aaron Burns-Lees. This is from The National on Friday, the 22nd of March, 2024, from the news section. Tory Minister Mel Stride: "Concern for mental health has gone too far." This article is written by Steph Braun. A Tory minister has insisted concern for people's mental health may have gone too far. Mel Stride, the Work and Pensions Secretary, said in an interview with the Daily Telegraph he feared some people were now convincing themselves they have some kind of serious mental health condition, as opposed to the normal anxieties of life. He added he had concerns about people who had concerns about their mental health driving up the benefit bill. Stride was making the comment to defend changes to the Work Capability Assessment, a process used to decide when people qualify for sickness benefits because they are too ill to work. The government is making the rules stricter, with plans to make 150,000 people signed off work with mild conditions look for a job. He told the paper, "While I'm grateful for today's more open approach to mental health, there is a danger that this has gone too far. There is a real risk now that we are labelling the normal ups and downs of human life as medical conditions, which then actually serve to hold people back and ultimately drive up the benefit bill. If they go to the doctor and say, 'I'm feeling rather down and bluesy,' the doctor will give them on average about 7 minutes and then, on 94% of occasions, they will be signed off as not fit to carry out any work whatsoever." He added, "An honest, grown-up debate was needed. It is too important for people and their futures, too important for the way that welfare works, and too important for the economy to just ignore." While opening himself up to this debate, Stride now has another issue on his hands after a major report concluded women born in the 1950s, impacted by changes to the state pension age, are owed compensation. The Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman said the Department for Work and Pensions has clearly indicated it will refuse to comply with the recommendation, and Parliament has subsequently been asked to intervene and ensure a compensation scheme is set up. The DWP has also been told to apologise for its failings. That article was written by Steph Braun.
This is from The National on Monday, 25th March 2024. From the News section. Grangemouth Oil Refinery to close, despite posting £100 million profit. By Xander Elliards. Scotland's only oil refinery, which is set to close with the loss of hundreds of jobs, has posted record profits of more than £100 million, prompting renewed calls for action to save it. The Herald first reported that Petronius Manufacturing Scotland Limited, which owns and operates the oil refinery in Grangemouth, posted pre-tax annual profits of £107.4 million. The result was a huge turnaround from the £50.5 million loss posted the year before and has led to calls for government intervention. Alba MP Kenny McCaskill, whose party has been running a campaign aimed at saving the Grangemouth refinery, said, "North Sea oil is and has been pivotal to the UK economy. It's perverse that Scotland's oil should be refined elsewhere and that Scotland's industrial base is trashed whilst the UK Treasury coins in the cash. If Grangemouth is allowed to shut, Scotland will be the only major oil-producing nation without a refinery. It'll put us alongside developing nations such as the Republic of Congo and Trinidad and Tobago, both of whom produce less oil than Scotland. The UK has made billions from North Sea oil. They're providing hundreds of millions to INEOS to open a plant in Belgium and have funded foreign battery plants in England to a similar tune. It's time a modest sum was given to Grangemouth from all the billions taken from the North Sea to shore up Scotland's economy." As The National revealed earlier this month, the UK government has backed a Petronius project in Belgium with around £600 million, but has refused to step in on Grangemouth. Reacting to news of the £107 million in profits, Green MSP Mark Ruskell said it was yet another massive slap in the face for workers in Grangemouth. "Workers and their families in the Forth Valley and across Fife have given decades of their lives to the Grangemouth plant, and now, whilst the corporate giants are turning over huge profits, they are turning their backs on the communities who built them," he added. Owners Petronius announced the refinery will operate as normal until at least spring 2025. However, it will then begin transitioning to an oil import terminal. In 2023, Scottish Energy Secretary Mary McCallan insisted that ministers were only told of the plans to close Grangemouth's oil refinery at the same time as workers and the UK government. Sharon Graham, the General Secretary of Unite, which represents many of the refinery workers, said at the time, "Grangemouth workers are angry over the failure by the Scottish and UK governments to bring forward any proposals that support their livelihoods." In March, the trade union then hit out at total silence from the Scottish Government on how it planned to help Grangemouth stay open for as long as possible, one of their stated aims. That article was by Xander Elliards. This is from The National on Monday, 25th March, 2024. From the Politics section. New £200 million nuclear fund slammed as grotesque by SNP. By Joe Sullivan. The SNP have hit out at Rishi Sunak after he announced £200 million in funding to secure the future of the UK's nuclear industry. The new funds will finance community initiatives and workforce investments in Barrow-in-Furness, where Britain's new Trident submarines are under construction. MP Martin Doherty-Hughes, the SNP's defence spokesperson, described the move as grotesque and said that it showed Westminster is focused on the wrong priorities. He said, "Westminster has already wasted billions of taxpayers' money on nuclear weapons and expensive nuclear energy. It is grotesque to throw another £200 million down the drain when the Tories and Labour both claim there is no money to improve our NHS, to help families with the cost of living, or to properly invest in our green energy future. This money would be much better spent on a raft of other priorities, not least investing in the green energy gold rush, which would ensure Scotland can be a green energy powerhouse of the 21st century. Barrow hosts the UK's Astute-class nuclear attack submarines and is home to the shipyard building new Trident equipment submarines to be homeported at Faslane. It is hoped that the investment will see 8,000 jobs created in the nuclear sector, helping to meet a target of 40,000 new roles in the field by 2030. Sunak has committed a further £900 million in funding for the community over the next 5 years. Ahead of an appearance in the town tomorrow, the Prime Minister said, "Safeguarding the future of our nuclear deterrent and nuclear energy industry is a critical national endeavour. In a more dangerous and contested world, the UK's continuous at-sea nuclear deterrent is more vital than ever. And nuclear delivers cheaper, cleaner, homegrown energy for consumers. That's why we are investing in Barrow, the home of UK submarines, and in the jobs and skills of the future in a thriving British nuclear industry." The new funding comes as the UK's non-nuclear military forces are facing a wide range of challenges. Several former commanders raised worries last month by suggesting the UK should reintroduce conscription amidst a slump in recruitment. Poor funding is also causing difficulty for the forces, with two Tory ministers recently insisting that defence spending be increased. Defence Secretary Grant Shapps has said he wants a bigger budget and called for military spending to be increased to 3% of GDP, in line with the UK's commitments to NATO. There was no new money for defence in the spring budget, with Chancellor Jeremy Hunt saying, "Our spending will rise to 2.5% of GDP as soon as economic conditions allow," but not detailing how that would happen. Dorothy Hughes said, "The urgent priority is more money for conventional defence and for our armed forces who are underpaid and under-resourced." With both Sunak and Starmer focused on the wrong priorities, it is only the SNP standing up for Scotland's interests and Scotland's values. That article is by Joe Sullivan. This is from The National on Monday, 25th March, 2024. From the News section. When do clocks go forward, UK? Date clocks change in 2024. By Joshua Searle. Days are getting longer. Spring has begun, and attention is turning to when the clocks will go forward, giving us even more daylight. Each year, the clocks are moved back in autumn and moved forward again in spring, yet many of us still get caught out by an hour. The clocks moving forward in spring will mark the start of British summer as we move from Greenwich Mean Time to British Summer Time. Here's everything you need to know about the UK clock changes in 2024. When do the clocks go forward in 2024? The clocks always go forward at 1 a.m. on the final Sunday of March, which this year falls on Sunday, March 31st. The reason for the time is to cause limited disruption to schools and businesses. Unfortunately, it means your weekend will be cut short by 1 hour, but in return, we will see more daylight in the evening. When do the clocks go back in 2024? In autumn, the clocks will go back again at 2 a.m. on the final Sunday of October, which this year falls on Sunday, October 27th. It means an extra hour in bed for your Sunday lie-in and will give an extra hour of daylight as the dark nights roll in. Why do we change the clocks? The principal reason we change the clocks is to get the most out of daylight. The first clock change was introduced by the German government in 1916 and during the First World War as a means of saving energy. The longer the daylight hours lasted, the less electricity was required. Many European governments followed suit, including Britain, and so BST was born, with a current system in place since 1971. That article was by Joshua Searle.
The National, recorded on Wednesday, 27th of March, 2024. The Culture Section. Ewan McGregor, I'm Scottish wherever I am in the world, by James Walker, multimedia journalist. Trainspotting star Ewan McGregor has said that people from Scotland still tell him to remember where I come from, but insisted that nobody needs to. The Star Wars actor, 52, who was born in Perthshire, said he is Scottish wherever I am in the world. Speaking to the Radio Times, he said, I left Scotland at 17 to go to drama school in London. I haven't lived in Britain since 2008. I've been living in the States. It was hard to leave Scotland, he added. There's a sense you're turning your back. People in Scotland to this day tell me to remember where I come from. I know where I come from. I don't need anybody to remind me. It's this feeling of you're not Scottish enough. I'm Scottish wherever I am in the world. I'm always Scottish. McGregor, who's starring in the upcoming Paramount Plus TV series A Gentleman in Moscow alongside his second wife, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, spoke about the importance of using an intimacy coordinator on set. The actor plays Alexander Rostov in the historical fiction drama about a Russian aristocrat who is spared from death and put under house arrest while the Bolshevik Revolution plays out. Winstead, 39, who's known for playing Ramona Flowers in Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, portrays Anna Urbanova, who seduces Alexander. McGregor said, we did have an intimacy coordinator. It's still necessary because it's also about the crew, and it's odd to be naked in front of people. It's odd to be intimate in front of the camera. If you were doing a dance scene, you'd have a choreographer. It's an important part of the work now, because it's somebody that the director and actors meet in the middle. The Scottish actor also appeared alongside American actress Winstead in the TV series Fargo. McGregor and Winstead welcomed a child together in 2021 and get married in 2022. Prior to this, he was married to production designer Eve Mavrakis for more than two decades. By James Walker. The National, recorded on Monday, 25th of March, 2024. The Culture Section. Exclusive interview. Scottish actor Paul Higgins and the 10 Things That Changed His Life. By Adam Robertson, multimedia journalist. The National spoke with Scottish actor Paul Higgins ahead of the premiere of his new play, This Is Memorial Device. More information on tickets can be found at lyceum.org.uk. 1. Going to a seminary. I went to junior seminary when I was 12, training to be a missionary priest. That was a kind of boarding school in Coatbridge, not far from Wishaw, where I grew up. But we lived there almost all the time. It was an Italian order, so I was sort of partly raised by all these Italian guys from a very different culture. I had a great time, I have to say, though obviously I didn't become a priest. When I realised that I couldn't do celibacy and wasn't sure about God, all the things you need to be sure about, I was still reluctant to leave because I had such good friends there. You hear horror stories about seminaries, but I'd never heard of any about that one. That was a place we didn't watch TV, we held things in common, and didn't really have possessions, we had time for meditation. For a working class boy from the west of Scotland, it was an amazing opportunity to see life in a different way. 2. Joining a drama club. After I left the seminary, I was going to go to the University of Glasgow. I had the qualifications, but I hadn't applied because I was going to be a priest. I got left in the lurch and went to Our Lady's High in Motherwell. I joined the drama group, and we got invited just to sing because I was a singer and the drama group did musicals. We went to a drama camp in Cumbernauld shortly before I was meant to go to university. The theatre director gave me a lead part in this thing we were devising. I'd never thought of myself as an actor, not for one second,
but he gave me the lead part and asked why I was going to university. I didn't really have an answer other than everybody being proud. So I took a year out and auditioned for drama schools and got into Central in London, and that was a massive moment in my life. 3. Living in London. It was a big deal from a guy from Wishaw, and being around people I'd never met before. People in my class, one person was the daughter of a very famous novelist. I'd never met anyone like that in my life, so that opened my eyes, and just living in that huge multicultural metropolis. At that time, certainly Wishaw, but even Glasgow was a more monoracial, monocultural place. 4. Going to a cattle market. I went to research a job in Carrickmacross in Ireland, and there was a cattle market there. Funnily enough, I'd grown up next to a cattle market. Cows used to come down our street with a field at one end and the market at the other. There'd be cow ... all over the road. In Carrickmacross, I'd be about 27. I had a look at this market for something to do, and the cows were being unloaded from trucks, and these boys were sitting in the wall. One of them had a massive long cane. His job was just to batter very casually and without animosity the cows until they got up. I went back to my digs, and the only thing for dinner was beef stew. I couldn't stomach it, and I haven't eaten meat since that night, and that was 35 years ago or something like that. I thought it was for one night only, but I'd never touched it since. 5. Stopping smoking. I was a chain smoker and a heavy drinker, but when I met my wife, I decided to stop. I used to smoke about 50 a day. I once smoked 80 in a day, so I stopped that and started running pretty much at the same time. I've been running ever since and not smoking ever since, and it was one of the best things I ever did, was to stop killing myself. 6. Mike Alfreds. He's a theatre director, an American guy that lives in London. I didn't meet him until I was 30-something, my early 30s anyway. I didn't really understand acting. He's written a couple of influential books, one is called Different Every Night, but it was like 3 years of drama school and 1 month's rehearsal. He completely changed my approach to acting and what it's for and how it's done. To this day, I'm influenced by his ideas. I worked with him a couple of times, but he's been very influential to a lot of people, guys like Mark Rylance. He was a hard taskmaster. He annoyed people. He wouldn't be upset by that. He knows he upsets people, but he taught me that it's not about what your character is feeling, which you get obsessed with as an actor. They're internal. They don't communicate to an audience. If you think of what your character's feeling, make your character do. So still thinking about them, but taking it to the next level and asking what they make you do or try to do. When you're trying to do something with someone else on stage, that's transmittable to the audience. It's not about your internal workings, it's something you're putting out into the world. 7. Writing. I always wanted to be a writer, but didn't believe in it somehow. I went to therapy for a while and started writing, trying to understand my dad, really. A play came out of that, Nobody Will Ever Forgive Us, for the National Theatre of Scotland. I got over that hump of wanting to be a writer to managing to sit down and be able to finish something and see it produced. It was a great production, the director did a great job with the cast, and I've kept writing since then. It stayed with me. 8. The Thick of It. I absolutely loved doing The Thick of It. I didn't do it for that long. I think I joined for the second 3, which were then shown as a series of 6, but they were made as 2 batches of 3. I did a couple of hour-long specials which I really enjoyed because there was more scope for the characters and did the film in the loop. I had a great time doing it. I loved that process where you shoot a lot of material and they sort it out for you. 9. Stopping drinking and becoming vegan. This book called Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer turned me vegan pretty much overnight. I've been vegan for 14 years and I'm an ambassador for the Vegan Society. I've been a trustee of the Vegan Society as well, so that's a big thing in my life. I also stopped drinking just past 6 years ago. I was very reliant on alcohol to relax, to socialise. Every occasion was one for alcohol, but stopping was one of the best things I ever did. 10. This is Memorial Device. We did this play 2 years ago at the Edinburgh Festival. I was doing another play and I got given the book This is Memorial Device. I hadn't read it, but it was sent to me. It's set in Airdrie at a time when I was young or younger than I am now. We set up a meeting with Graham Ito, who is directing and adapted David Keenan's amazing novel. I didn't know how he could make it a one-man show. I should say it's not really one man because there's taped interviews, but there's only one actor in the flesh. Graham did a fantastic job of adapting. I loved doing it and the audience responded well. It's very funny and unusual in what it tries to do. It's entertaining and it's funny, but you go on a journey with it that takes you to unexpected places, including me, and I'm trying to take the audience with me. It's so good to be involved in something so engaging and entertaining, but demanding as well, and to find that audiences really responded to it is fantastic. To have another chance to do this, not just in Edinburgh, but also in Glasgow, Aberdeen and London, is a dream. By Adam Robertson.
From the National, Tuesday the 26th of March, from the comments section. The cost of Westminster cuts will be clear to Scotland's electorate. By Karen Adam, MSP, columnist. During my engagement with constituents, whether through my office or out on doorsteps, doing my street surgeries as an MSP or chapping up folk to canvass in my activist role, I've come across a recurring theme which underpins much of our political discourse. It centres on the differing of responsibilities among UK, Scottish and local governments, and a confusion which significantly affects how policies are perceived and how grievances are directed. Often it is the complexity of cash flow and jurisdiction between these layers of governance, which has stood out as an area desperately needing clarity. I've listened to constituents rightly voice concerns over local issues, from educational adjustments to local social care provisions, not realising the varied areas of decision making that controls these services, even within local devolution. A stark illustration of this has been complaints to my office regarding the decision by the Conservative/Liberal Democrat-led council in Aberdeenshire, which, in a move marked by a lack of foresight and consultation, chose to deprioritise critical services for some of our most vulnerable citizens. The cutting of speech and language services in educational settings is a devastating blow for some of our additional support needs children. Such decisions not only display an alarming disconnect from the needs of our communities, but also highlight the lack of foresight and decision-making when the leader of the council said she doesn't understand all the workings of the council. It's not just damaging, it's quite frankly dangerous. The uproar over overnight closures of the minor injuries unit in Peterhead is another prime example. While the Tory MP David Duguid expressed outrage in the press, it was, in fact, Tory councillors who voted for the closure, starkly contrasting with the position of our SNP councillors, one of whom is Westminster SNP candidate Seamus Logan, who stood firmly against it. Blaming the Scottish Government for his own party colleague's decision seems disingenuous from Duguid. This disconnect and the lack of transparent communication betray a deeper issue within our political fabric. The advantages some take of an electorate unsure of who is responsible for what. If we look at the political chess game that governs our public finances, there's a dissonance between the austerity imposed by Labour politicians at UK level, and then the criticism directed at Scotland when the unavoidable cuts and adjustments are made here. It's a bit like being handed a half-empty toolkit and then being criticised for not building the full furniture set. The truth is, the financial constraints placed on Scotland by decisions made in Westminster have tangible impacts, especially when it comes to public services and welfare provisions. What we must get across to the electorate is that despite these constraints, Scotland has taken a different approach, focusing on protecting the most vulnerable in our society. In the face of ongoing austerity, we've launched initiatives such as the Scottish Child Payment, increasing spending on carers, distributed baby boxes to new parents and mitigated the bedroom tax. We've upheld the sanctity of free prescriptions in education, recognising these not as luxuries but as fundamental rights. These aren't just policies, they're lifelines for those in the fringes, a testament to government that chooses compassion over cuts. However, maintaining this level of support and protection against a backdrop of tightening budgets is an uphill battle. Each financial year becomes a juggling act of priorities, with the Scottish Government straining to cushion the blow of UK-level decisions. It's a precarious position, balancing fiscal responsibility while striving to uphold social welfare commitments. The prospect of change with a new Labour government at the UK level has been met with a lingering concern, as it seems to be more of the same under a different banner. The rhetoric so far doesn't promise a radical departure from the status quo, and that's disheartening for those of us in Scotland who see the potential for a different, more equitable path forward. Another short-sighted, and dare I say cynically vote-grabbing, policy of tax cuts exacerbates the challenges of funding public services. They can lead to a vicious cycle where reduced services necessitate further cuts or privatisation, undermining the quality and accessibility of the essential public services. This approach also shifts the burden disproportionately onto lower and middle income families who rely more on public services. This is being done in full knowledge of the struggle our NHS is facing. 14 years of austerity in the pursuit of tax cuts by the UK government have significantly affected the Scottish Government's budget and, by extension, local government budgets. The direct link between austerity measures, reduced block grant funding and the constrained ability of local governments to provide services highlights a critical challenge. As Scotland handles these fiscal pressures, the emphasis must be on protecting public services, which are vital to the well-being of its citizens and the health of its economy. It's an election year, mostly filled with debates around Scotland's constitutional future, but it becomes increasingly vital to shine a light on government's fears and responsibilities and foster a well-informed electorate. The path to empowerment and informed decision-making lies in understanding the structures that shape our daily lives, from local councils to Westminster and Holyrood. Council elections and their councillors are vital to how our services are delivered and prioritised. Our commitment, then, must be to ensure when Scots step into the voting booth, they do so armed with the knowledge of not just who they are voting for, but also what. It is through this understanding that we can foster a political landscape led by accountability and transparency. The stark reality is that if Scotland remains tethered to the fiscal policies and priorities set in Westminster, our ability to chart our own course, especially in areas crucial to social welfare and economic justice, remains limited. It reinforces the argument that gaining full control over our financial decisions through independence isn't just a matter of national democracy. It's becoming increasingly vital for safeguarding the well-being of our citizens. And that was a comment piece by Karen Adam, MSP. From the National, Tuesday the 26th of March, from the news section, former Scottish Labour councillor jailed for paedophilia offences. Report by Tristan Stewart Robertson. A pervert former Scottish Labour councillor who hoarded hundreds of indecent images of children has been jailed. Craig Edward, 34, resigned as an independent councillor for Clydebank Central a month after pleading guilty to three sex crimes. He returned to Dumbarton Sheriff Court for sentencing on March 26th from his home in Calne, Wiltshire, England, having fled from Scotland. The court previously heard Edward's iPhone 10 was found with 599 still images and 93 videos of children, some as young as a baby. He had a child PVG certificate at the time. He had 69 still images at the most serious category A. Of the videos, 67 were the most serious, with one showing an alarmed and distressed baby. Police found 55 contacts in a group in the app Telegram, and Edward initiated conversation with the word trade 15 times. Six contacts participated in the trade of images. Officers are investigating the contacts. In February, he pleaded guilty to possession of indecent photographs or pseudo-photographs of children at an address in Crown Avenue and elsewhere on various occasions between March 6, 2016 and September 26, 2022. He also took or permitted to be taken or made indecent photos or pseudo-photos of children during the same period and on various occasions between September 20, 2022 and September 22, 2022. He distributed or showed indecent photos or pseudo-photos of children. During the period of his crimes, Edward was an SNP activist and tried to stand as councillor for the party before quitting for Labour. He was elected as a Labour councillor for Clydebank Central in May 2022 and removed from the party after he was arrested that September. Fellow Labour councillors had filed a motion to West Dumbartonshire Council calling for him to resign just before he quit with immediate effect earlier this month. In court today, he was jailed for 28 months. Edward was placed on a sexual harm prevention order for 5 years and placed on the Sex Offenders Register for 10 years. Sheriff William Gallagher said the descriptions of the images plumb the depths of depravity and abuse. Edward showed zero emotion when handed a sentence. An NSPCC Scotland spokesperson said, "As a loyal councillor, Edward held a position of trust within the community, yet, at home, he was downloading and creating horrendous images of child abuse. These crimes are far from victimless. By viewing and sharing illegal images of children, Edward has failed to mandate such material which can impact children for the rest of their lives. We hope the outcome of this demonstrates nobody is immune from the law, regardless of the position they hold in society. Any adults concerned about a child's safety or well-being can contact the NSPCC helpline at help@nspcc.org.uk or by calling 0808 800 5000. That's 0808 800 5000. Children who have been affected by this or any other issue can contact Childline on 0800 1111 or visit childline.org.uk. And that article was written by Tristan Stewart Robertson. From the National, Tuesday the 26th of March, from the politics section, Rishi Sunak takes issue with Joanna Cherry's Rwanda questions. This article was written by Sandra Ellards. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak clashed with SNP MP Joanna Cherry as she questioned him on whether actions he had taken in government made him proud. The Tory leader attempted to suggest that Cherry was using rhetoric which would put MPs in danger after she pushed him on why his party had been whipped against preventing Afghans who have supported the UK armed forces being sent to Rwanda. First, appearing as part of Westminster's liaison committee in her capacity as chair of the Human Rights Committee, Cherry asked Sunak, "The interim Prime Minister of Pakistan has referred to the UK's Rwanda policy in defence of his country's decision to expel from Pakistan hundreds of thousands of Afghans who fled from the Taliban regime. Are you proud that he used your Rwanda policy to justify doing that?" Sunak said he was obviously not responsible for what politicians in Pakistan said, calling Cherry's question bizarre. Cherry then said, "There's evidence that quite a high number of people fleeing the Taliban regime are reaching the United Kingdom shore on small boats. Are you proud that your members of parliament were whipped against voting for an amendment that would have prevented Afghans who had aided or supported His Majesty's armed forces in Afghanistan from being sent to Rwanda?" Sunak responded, "I really disagree with that characterisation. Given we've just had all these debates in Parliament about opposition day debates and what they do to MPs and intimidation, I actually think characterising like that is deeply unhelpful." The Prime Minister's reference was to an SNP opposition day debate which saw Speaker Lindsay Hoyle ignore official advice, change parliamentary rules and allow a Labour motion to be debated. Hoyle insisted that a prior meeting with Keir Starmer had not influenced his decision and claimed it was made to protect MPs. Cherry said she resented Sunak linking her question to that. She said, "I have to say, Prime Minister, I resent your characterisation. I'm asking you a perfectly reasonable question. There are people coming to our shores who have previously aided and abetted our armed forces in Afghanistan, and you whipped your MPs against an amendment which would have prevented them from being deported to Rwanda. I'm asking you whether you are proud of that." Sunak responded, "We have a very clear obligation to make sure that we support those who aided us in Afghanistan, and we are delivering on that. We have multiple different schemes which I've discussed in this committee in the past, three strands of them. Those schemes are operating and bringing thousands of Afghans safely to the UK in a way which is sustainable and where we can provide them with the appropriate support they need when they are here." Elsewhere at the committee hearing, Sunak refused to comment on former Prime Minister Liz Truss's claims about a deep state, words which are widely seen to be part of far-right conspiracy theories. Sunak would only say the comments were a question for Truss, quipping that he would not tell MPs if he were part of the deep state. An article was written by Xander Eliards and read by me, Ian McKenna. From the National, Tuesday the 26th of March, from the politics section. Tory minister resigns from UK government in blow to Rishi Sunak. By Xander Eliards. A Tory minister has resigned from Rishi Sunak's government. Robert Halfone unexpectedly quit as an education minister on Tuesday. In a letter to the Prime Minister, he said, "I believe that across the country there is a quiet admiration for your work ethic, integrity and ability to solve complex problems faced by our country. I look forward to continuing to wholeheartedly support you from the backbenches in the weeks and months ahead, at the upcoming election, and, of course, to spending my remaining time as an MP, championing Harlow." The news comes as James Heppie confirmed his resignation as Armed Forces Minister, saying he has loved every minute in the role. The Tory MP for Wales posted on Twitter/X, "I loved every minute as Minister of AF in this incredible department. Our armed forces and MOD civil servants are the very best of us. Representing them in Parliament and around the world over the last 4.5 years has been an amazing privilege." The two resignations mean Sunak will have to hold a mini reshuffle of his ministers over Easter, with recess beginning on Tuesday. In the article is by Xander Eliards.
The National Politics on Wednesday, the 27th of March. The First Minister is hailed as the leader Scotland needs after 1 year as the SNP chief. An article written by Xander Eliards. Hamza Yousaf is today marking 1 year since he became SNP leader. The First Minister, who will mark his official anniversary as the head of the Scottish Government on Friday, was praised by his depute in the SNP for being the leader Scotland needs. Keith Brown said, "Where we see other party leaders hiding when things get tough, the First Minister has stood up with courage and integrity when it has mattered most, not least in leading calls for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. That's the leadership Scotland needs, and that's the leadership we see in Hamza Yousaf. And together, we will achieve the future that Scotland needs as an independent country." However, unionist parties have leapt on the opportunity to criticise Mr. Yousaf. Scottish Labour group leader Anna Sawa pointed to the loss of the Rutherglen and Hamilton West by-election and the defection of two elected members, Ash Reagan MSP to the Alba Party and MP Lisa Cameron to the Conservatives, as well as MP Angus McNeill leaving the party. Scottish Tory leader Douglas Ross highlighted more than 100 instances of what he claimed were failures during Mr. Yousaf's time in office, including missing A&E waiting times targets, the publication of new independence white papers, and the country's economy. Mr. Sawa said, "After a year in post, it's clear to see that Hamza Yousaf is a weak leader who is out of his depth and leading a chaotic and divided government that is not delivering for Scotland. Every sector of our public services is now weaker, thanks to Hamza Yousaf's SNP." Mr. Ross said, "Hamza Yousaf's first year as SNP leader has been nothing short of a disaster for him, his party, and most importantly, the people of Scotland. It's a tale of independence obsession, abject failures and broken promises, of a First Minister out of his depth and unable to control his feuding, scandal-ridden party." A spokesperson for the First Minister dismissed the criticism, saying it was the opposition party's job to oppose, and the job given to them by the electorate for the past 17 years and counting. They went on, "The most recent polling evidence is that the SNP remains ahead of the opposition on who people trust on health, education, the economy and the cost of living. The First Minister is governing on the basis of clear values, prioritising investment in public services, helping people with a cost of living crisis by freezing council tax, supporting business opportunities in Scotland, and showing leadership on major issues, such as consistently calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza." Mr. Brown listed similar achievements from Mr. Yousaf, saying he demonstrated leadership and policy decisions based on clear values. Mr. Yousaf was elected as leader of the SNP on March the 27th last year, narrowly beating Kate Forbes in the second round of voting. He was sworn in as First Minister 2 days later, officially replacing Nicola Sturgeon. An article written by Xander Eliads. The National. Politics. On Wednesday, the 27th of March. Matheson says he will not resign as an MSP over the iPad bill row. An article written by Xander Eliads. Former Scottish Health Secretary Michael Matheson has insisted he will not resign as an MSP amid ongoing backlash to an £11,000 iPad roaming bill. The SNP MSP was questioned by journalists at Holyrood yesterday for the first time since the Scottish Parliamentary Corporate Body issued findings that he had breached parliamentary rules. Asked if he would resign as an MSP, Mr. Matheson said, "No, as you know, there is a standards process at the moment, and I'm going to respect the confidentiality of that process, and I look forward to the process being completed shortly." He did not respond to further questions from journalists. Mr. Matheson quit his cabinet role in February, following months of pressure over a five-figure data roaming bill racked up on his parliamentary iPad during a family holiday to Morocco. He had initially asked the taxpayer to foot the bill, but later said he would pay it himself. Earlier in March, the Scottish Parliamentary Corporate Body, the cross-party group of MSPs tasked with the running of Parliament, concluded that Mr. Matheson had broken the code of conduct for members over his handling of the bill and referred his case to the Holyrood Standards, Procedures and Public Appointments Committee to consider sanctions. The Tories have urged Humza Yousaf to remove the whip from the Falkirk West MSP, but he has said the former minister is a decent person that has made a mistake. Appearing on the BBC's Sunday show earlier this month, Mr. Yousaf said, "There are MSPs that have made mistakes and they've had to face the consequences of those mistakes." An article written by Xander Eliads. The National. News. On Wednesday, the 27th of March. New fund could revive Scotland to Europe ferry. An article written by James Walker. A new UK government fund could help re-establish a direct ferry route from Scotland to Europe very soon, campaigners have argued. SNP MP Douglas Chapman has written to Levelling Up Secretary Michael Gove and the Chief Executive of Forth Greenport to encourage them to help with a ferry route's application for funding via the UK government's £150 million Investment Opportunity Fund. It could well deliver all the initial investment required to get the Euroferry service up and running very soon, the local Dunfermline and West Fife MP said. It came after plans to launch the route in May this year were put on hold due to a lack of financial support from the Scottish and UK governments. In January, Derek Sloan, the shipping expert behind the project to restore the route, told The National that considerable progress had been made, but warned that plans won't take off without backing from either Westminster or Holyrood. Ferry operator DFDS said at the time that the lack of backing made the business case for the route less viable. DFDS added at the time, however, that they still remain firm in our belief that the route can operate on a sustainable financial basis. Mr. Chapman said that the awarding of this UK government funding would offer a strong signal to the market, as well as to DFDS, that would reduce risk while freight and passenger numbers are being built up. He said the demand for an efficient and regular direct ferry route into Europe from Rosyth remains buoyant, and meeting this need for both freight and passengers has been our driving force since the campaign started. While Scottish Government funds are limited, we are at the start of a new financial year and we'll keep pressing them for what is a relatively small amount of support, some of which could be provided in kind. Our attention, however, is now focused on the recently announced £150 million Investment Opportunity Fund, which the Forth Greenport could access and submit an application for in the coming months. An article written by James Walker. The National. On Wednesday, the 27th of March. Opinion. Michael Gove's mistake is nothing but Tory corruption. The Real Scottish Politics, an article written by the Wee Ginger Doug. Michael Gove has been a very naughty boy. The community secretary has apologised after failing to register VIP hospitality he enjoyed at three football matches between 2020 and 2022. The cabinet minister had been under investigation by the Parliamentary Standards Commissioner after The Guardian revealed that he had failed to disclose the VIP hospitality he and his son had been provided by Queen's Park Rangers Football Club and had not registered the gifts on the MP's Register of Interests, as he had been obliged to do by Commons rules. In a report published on Monday, Standards Commissioner Daniel Greenberg found that Mr. Gove had breached Commons rules by failing to declare the hospitality within 28 days. The failure relates to three separate occasions. He said it was an oversight, but this was a repeated breach, not a one-off incident. Try three oversights with the Department of Work and Pensions as a benefits claimant and see where that gets you. The DWP won't just accept your profuse apology and move on. You'd face significant and harsh sanctions. These are the draconian rules that Mr. Gove and his colleagues impose on others, but they won't accept facing similarly harsh sanctions when they break the rules themselves. But move along now. Mr. Gove has apologised. There's nothing to see here. It was an easy mistake to make, and as Mr. Gove himself remarked after Tory mega-donor Frank Hester apologised for making racist and misogynist remarks about Diane Abbott and wishing for her to be shot, we should show some Christian forgiveness. Mr. Gove clearly hopes that we will all empathise with him and do the same. After all, who among us has not had multiple free VIP trips to the football, thanks to a man we personally recommended for a massive PPE deal, and then forgotten to mention it, despite clearly knowing the rules? It's just a little oopsie, not governmental corruption at all. When you get so much free stuff, it's easy to have numerous oversights. Mr. Gove has also used MPs' expenses to claim a £331 Chinon armchair, a £493 Manchu cabinet, a £135 pair of elephant lamps, a £35 foam cot mattress, a £30 doormat, and patio furniture worth £219, all bought from a relation of David Cameron, who owned the shop. When caught out, Mr. Gove simply repaid the money and continued on untroubled in his career. He's used to free stuff. We should sympathise with Michael and his memory lapses. Cocaine will do that to you. His unfortunate oversight is certainly not something warranting serious sanctions, not like a benefits claimant who missed their appointment at the job centre because the privatised bus failed to turn up. They need to face severe consequences, and not like a Scottish Government minister whose teenage son ran up an £11,000 roaming charge bill watching football matches on an iPad, a bill which was fully paid back. Christian forgiveness is something that only Conservative cabinet ministers and racist Tory donors should benefit from. After all, wasn't Jesus famously harsh on the poor and the disabled? And now Rishi Sunak's woes are continuing. Tory MP Scott Benton has stood down as MP for Blackpool South with immediate effect, after being found to have breached parliamentary lobbying rules on numerous occasions. Mr. Benton had had the Tory whip removed after he was found to have offered to reporters who were posing as investors that he would lobby ministers in return for payments. A subsequent parliamentary investigation concluded that Mr. Benton had breached lobbying rules and recommended a 35-day suspension from the House of Commons. This period of suspension is long enough to trigger the constituency recall petition process, but Mr. Benton decided to jump before he was pushed, and there will now be a by-election in the constituency, most likely on the 2nd of May, the same day as local and mayoral elections in England. The Conservative majority in the constituency is 3,690, relatively slim by the standards of some other seats in which by-elections have recently been held, and where far larger Conservative majorities were overturned. Even under the best of circumstances, Blackpool South would be a challenging by-election for the Conservatives, but with Labour far ahead in the polls and a government which is constantly mired in scandal, the Tories' chances in this latest by-election are realistically zero. The only real question is the magnitude of their impending defeat. A group of well-known Scottish personalities from the worlds of acting, comedy and music have signed a joint letter calling for an immediate end to British arms exports to Israel, amongst concerns that weaponry and ammunition produced in the UK is being used by Israel to commit war crimes in Gaza, where over 32,000 people have now died since Israel began its assault on the Palestinian territory following the Hamas attacks on the 7th of October last year. To put that death toll into a Scottish context, it's roughly equivalent to the entire population of Motherwell or Dumfries. The open letter, coordinated by Oxfam, has been sent to both Foreign Secretary David Cameron and Trade Secretary Kemi Badenoch, and warns that if the UK refuses to stop selling these arms, it is complicit in the slaughter of civilians taking place daily in Gaza. The UK is an important supplier of arms to Israel. Figures collated by the campaign group Campaign Against Arms Trade claim that the UK has licensed over £489 million worth of military exports to Israel since 2015. Scott stars Brian Cox, Annie Lennox and Frankie Boyle have all signed the letter, as have comedian and presenter Nish Kumar, Aisling Bea and singer Paloma Faith. Scottish Green co-leaders Lorna Slater and Patrick Harvey and Plaid Cymru leader Rhian Ab Iorwerth have also put their names to the letter. A column written by the Wee Ginger Doug. The National. Politics. On Wednesday, the 27th of March. Watering down Scotland's climate goals would be an enormous mistake, warns a campaigner. An article written by Ross Hunter. The Scottish Government is being urged not to water down its climate commitments after an independent report found its plans to reach net zero were no longer credible. Last week, the UK's climate watchdog, the Climate Change Committee, said Scotland's goal of cutting harmful emissions by 75% by 2030 would require a large acceleration of reductions in most sectors. As such, it deemed the plans beyond what is credible and said there remained no comprehensive delivery strategy for meeting future emissions targets. Speaking at a briefing event organised by Scottish Environment Link and Stop Climate Chaos Scotland on Wednesday morning, the former director of Friends of the Earth Scotland, Dr. Richard Dixon, warned ministers against weakening the country's climate ambitions in the wake of the Climate Change Committee's report. Scotland wants to be seen as a leader on climate change. Setting ambitious targets is important, but a lack of action is now undermining the government's legal targets and its international credibility, he said. With the world's climate now changing even faster than scientists predicted, this is a time where we need greater leadership and higher levels of ambition. Those in public life who argue that it is too hard to decarbonise are out of step with public opinion and ignorant of the scientific reality. We are already starting to suffer the impacts of climate change, but if we act, we can still avoid the worst consequences. It would be an enormous mistake to water down our climate ambition or to further delay critical action, failing current and future generations both in Scotland and around the world. The Scottish Government delayed the publication of its climate change plan last year, stating that the UK Government's rollback on green policies had implications for Scotland. It comes after the Climate Change Committee warned that Scotland was losing its lead over the rest of the UK when it comes to climate policies, with a report stating that progress on cutting fossil fuel emissions had largely stalled in recent years. An article written by Ross Hunter.
The National, Thursday the 28th of March, from the news section. Cross-country rail workers to strike next month after dispute. Rail workers on cross-country are to strike in a dispute over union recognition. The Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, or RMT, said around 800 of its members would walk out on Saturday, April the 13th. The dispute involves workers in supervisory and clerical roles. The RMT said it had been excluded from talks on pay and policy issues. Mike Lynch, RMT General Secretary, said Cross Country's refusal to guarantee our representation of members in negotiations is a disgrace and will not be tolerated. Bosses cannot dictate who RMT members are represented by or be allowed to rip up long-standing agreements. Therefore, our whole membership in Cross Country will take strike action on April the 13th and our industrial campaign will continue until we reach a resolution. Cross Country, owned by Arriva, has run trains through Scotland, England and Wales since 2007. That was an article by James Walker. The National, Thursday the 28th of March, from the news section. Public health body urges Scots to take up offer of shingles vaccine. Those eligible are being urged to get vaccinated against shingles, a condition which develops in 1 in 4 adults. Shingles is caused by the same virus behind chickenpox, which can become active again later in life. Public Health Scotland, PHS, said the vaccine helps build up immunity and reduces the risk of developing shingles by more than 70%. It said this is especially important for older people as the virus is more likely to become active again among that group and can also be more painful. Since January, local health boards in Scotland have been writing to all those currently eligible to invite them to come forward for their free shingles vaccination. Dr. Sam Gebru-Hewitt, PHS Head of Immunisation and Vaccination, visited the Edlewood Vaccination Centre in the NHS Lanarkshire Health Board area on Tuesday to highlight the importance of the vaccination programme. He said, around 400 people aged 70 and over are hospitalised due to shingles-related complications every year in Scotland. The shingles vaccine is a safe and effective way of reducing the likelihood of getting shingles. I am pleased to join NHS Lanarkshire's vaccination team at Edlewood today and see people come forward for the shingles vaccine, which will protect them from getting shingles and associated complications. As well as reducing your risk of getting shingles, taking up the offer of the vaccine reduces your risk of experiencing long-term pain and being hospitalised. Public Health Scotland continues to work closely with all health boards to ensure as many people as possible receive their shingles vaccine and protect themselves from shingles and its complications, such as post-herpetic neuralgia, where nerve pain lasts for several months after the shingles rash is gone. Those eligible include people who are aged 65 or 70 on September 2023, excluding people who were aged 66 to 69 on this date. Also eligible are 71 to 79-year-olds who were not previously vaccinated and those aged 50 or over who are about to start immunosuppressive therapy or have a severely weakened immune system. It is also available to those 18 or over who have received a stem cell transplant or have had CAR T therapy. PHS said 1 in 4 adults develop shingles and 1 in 5 people with shingles go on to develop longer lasting pain. Toby Tobias, vaccination manager at NHS Lanarkshire, said shingles is caused by the same virus that causes chickenpox and it can lie inactive after you recover from the chickenpox. The virus can become active again in later life when you have a weakened immune system due to age, stress, or other illnesses. The shingles vaccine helps reduce the risk of shingles developing, and if you do develop it, the vaccine reduces how serious the symptoms will be. Getting your vaccine when invited is the best way to help protect yourself against shingles. The main symptom of shingles is pain followed by a rash. This was an article by Ross Hunter. The National, Thursday the 28th of March, from the news section. Glasgow Bridge to be demolished over Easter weekend. A Glasgow bridge will be demolished over the Easter weekend. Network Rail will pull down the bridge deck over the railway at Shields Road and clear the debris from the track. Teams will then focus on preparing for construction of the new bridge deck, which promises to better serve the community. For public safety, the temporary footbridge over the railway will be closed during demolition. Work will take place between 6 a.m. on Saturday, March the 30th, and 6 a.m. on Sunday, March the 31st. Diversions will be put in place for pedestrians and cyclists in the meantime. The fastest route on roads will be via St Andrews Road, Maxwell Road, Eglinton Street, Kilburnie Street, West Street, Scotland Street and vice versa, taking around 30 minutes to walk or 5 to 10 minutes to cycle. Laura Craig, Network Rail's project manager for the bridge work, said, "Demolishing the bridge deck at Shields Road is a significant milestone for the project, and with it removed, we can focus on building the new bridge, which will better serve the community. Unfortunately, the footbridge cannot be used during part of the demolition weekend. We know this is inconvenient for those living and working in the area, but is the only way that the work can be delivered safely and efficiently. We will be working continuously from Friday night until Monday morning to complete this vital piece of engineering work. Engineers will remove the overhead line equipment that powers electric trains before the demolition begins, and will reconnect them in a new position when work is complete. Materials that will be used in the construction of the new bridge deck will then be moved into position ahead of its installation later in the year. The work at Shields Road is part of a £12.6 million package of engineering works taking place across Scotland's railway over the Easter bank holiday weekend." This was an article by Kirsty Feerick. The National, Thursday the 28th of March, from the news section. SNP deny claim that they are moving out of headquarters in Edinburgh. The SNP are not relocating from their headquarters in Edinburgh, the National can confirm. It comes after rumours started by Wings Over Scotland blog, which claimed on social media that the party was doing a bunk from their fancy offices in Edinburgh. In a blog post published on Tuesday, entitled Moving Out, the website Stuart Campbell highlighted a listing for office space with commercial property agents FT Linden. The listing was for the third floor of Gordon Lamb House at Jackson's Close in the Scottish capital, which is the office space used by the SNP and is listed as their address on their website. Campbell wrote, "It's a little surprising that they're suddenly doing a flip now. We wonder if there might be a downsizing in the offing." The Wings Over Scotland blog pointed to reports from August 2021 that said the SNP had spent more than £670,000 on furnishing, computer equipment and software development in the past year. It added, "We have no idea where they are now or going in the near future, but we doubt it will be somewhere ritzier. In brackets, maybe Police Scotland have some slightly used blue tents available, or will let them move into a camper van," close brackets. The blog post was shared on social media, with ALBA MP Neil Hanvey writing, "Well, this is interesting." However, the SNP and letting agents have both confirmed to the National that the party will not be leaving the headquarters. In a flat denial, a party source told this paper that the SNP had moved into the office in Gordon Lamb House in 2009, and would continue to work from it with no plans to relocate. The National was further told that it was standard practice for letting agents to list commercial space ahead of a lease expiring, in case new occupants needed to be found. It is understood that the SNP's lease expires in 2 months. However, it was confirmed by FT Linden that the current tenant, the SNP, has reached a verbal agreement on terms to extend the lease, and that will be finalised by solicitors. On the agent's website, no rent pricing is given. That was an exclusive article by Xander Eliards.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Q and Review, and to tell your friends about our service.